One of the first dramatic stories, conflict between good and evil, in Chumash Mos, a Chumash that is full of dramatic stories and conflicts between good and evil, is the inspiring tale of the heroic midwives, their refusal to cooperate with Paro's genocidal order. It says, Melech Mitzrayim told the Mialados HaIvrios, one was Shifra, one was Pua. He told them, Bialad Chenes HaIvrios, Risen Al HaAvnoyim, when you birth the Hebrews and you see the baby, if it's a son, V'Hamitenoso, kill it, in Basi V'Chaya, daughter, you let it live. It says, the Pasuk records, V'Tirena HaMialados HaSoilokim, the midwives feared God, they did the right thing, V'lo Asu Kasher Diber Alehen Melech Mitzrayim, they did not listen to Paro's order, V'Tachayena HaSayiladim, and they let the babies live. According to the Talmud, not only do they not kill them, they actually actively help them. They provided aid and help for the babies. Melech Mitzrayim was not pleased. Why did you do this? You didn't listen to what I said. You even actively facilitated the well-being of these babies. So the Mialados gave him a song and dance. They told him, they don't even need us. They do it without us. They gave some kind of excuse to Paro. Pasuk says, "Vayitev Elokim lamialados." Hashem rewarded them. He provided them with good. Vayirev ha'am, and the people prospered. The Jewish people prospered. They increased. Vayatzu ma'od. Again, the Torah says, "Vayhi ki yaru hamialados to Elokim," because the midwives feared God. They did the right thing. Vayas lahem batim. And then Paro saw that his surreptitious veiled genocide wasn't going to work because he couldn't secure the cooperation of the midwives. Paro just pulled out all the stops. He gave an open order to his entire people. Lemar, kol ben ha'ilod, hayaret hashlichu, kill all the male children, v'chol abas t'chayun. That is the story of the Mialados. Now, for years, the standard interpretation of this story with which I was familiar was the one brought by Rashi, which is largely based on the Talmud Bavli and Masechta Sota. Who were these Mialados? Isho Bita, mother and daughter, or alternatively, Kala V'Chamosa, mother-in-law and daughter-in-law. Who are the mother and daughter? Yocheved and Miriam, that is the better-known pshat. The other opinion, Kala V'Chamosa, Yocheved and Elisheva, Yocheved and her daughter-in-law, Aaron's wife, Elisheva. Okay, so these were two particular midwives. They, even though the Torah calls them Shifra and Pua, the Talmud explains these were kind of nicknames or professional names based on their midwife activities. Yocheved was called Shifra because she mishaperes hasavalad. She made the newborns. She prepared them. She helped them. She settled them and organized them. Or Shifra because paru v'ravu Yisrael. They were fruitful. Pua zu Miriam. Pua, either because it means she made it's a kind of onomatopoeia. She pooed at the Vlad. She would make comforting noises. Or Pua means she spoke Baruch HaKodesh, and she said, my mother will have a child who will be the Redeemer of Israel. Okay, famous pshat, Yocheved and Miriam. The Talmud goes on. The Talmud says that the midwives feared God. They didn't do what Paro said. The Gemara says, not only didn't they kill the children, Maspikaslam, Mayim Umazon, they provided water and food, they actively help keep the children alive. They actually did the exact opposite of what Paro wanted. What does it mean? What was their excuse to Paro that the Jews are chayos? What does chayos mean? It seems to mean midwives. The chaya in Hebrew often means midwife. So that they were saying the Jews are their own midwives. They don't need us. But a midwife also needs another midwife. A midwife who's giving birth can't really attend to herself. I mean, she might be an expert, but she's occupied. It's hard for her to treat herself while she's actually giving birth. So the Gemara says it means they're like chayos, like animals, like we read yesterday in the Torah. Yehuda is compared to a lion, Dan is compared to a serpent, Naphtali is compared to a deer, Yisachar to a donkey, Yosef to an ox, Binyamin to a wolf. Animals don't need midwives. Animals can give birth. All the other Shvatim, there was a catch-all, they're all compared to lions, lionesses. Animals can give birth without midwives. God made the world like that. Humans need all kinds of support, and animals manage on their own. The Jewish people can give birth on their own. They don't need us. We're really superfluous, and we don't have the opportunity to do what you wanted. It says, the Mialados feared God. He made batim. He made houses for them. What are houses? Strange pasuk. Rav and Shmuel, one says, Bate Kehuna Leviah. They had descendants who were Kohanim and Leviim. Other one says, Bate Malchus. They had descendants who were royalty. Kohanim and Leviim refer to Aaron and Moshe. Again, Yocheved's, these were the Yocheved's children, and Miriam was their sister. And the one who said Bate Malchus, kings, David is a descendant of Miriam. Miriam married into Yehuda's family, and eventually the Malchus based David, the Davidic lineage, came from Miriam. Okay, that is the pshat of the Talmud. That's how the Talmud understands the story. That's what Rashi brings, and that was the pshat I was always most familiar with. There are some interesting alternate approaches in some of the classic commentaries. One thing that puzzles a number of the commentaries is, what does it mean that there were two Mialados? Two? The Jews numbered in the hundreds of thousands. I don't know how many they numbered exactly right then, but when they left Egypt, there were hundreds of thousands. It sounds like there were a lot of Jews already back then. So I understand, you know, Medicare reimbursements were low maybe, or the insurance, malpractice premiums were high, but still two midwives for a whole nation. So the Mefarshim bring various pshatim. Ibn Ezra says these were the chiefs, these were the saros, these were the kind of the head midwife. They were the ones that had some kind of organized, they were the head of the organization of Jewish midwives in Egypt or something. So these were the chief midwives. He says there must have been at least 500 midwives, Ibn Ezra says. These were the bosses. These were the superior midwives. He told them, and he hoped that his commands to them would percolate down to their underlings. He brings Chazal that it was mother and daughter. That's a Kabbalah Chazal had. He says that these two chief midwives were mother and daughter. Chazal had a Kabbalah, Nachon, who Ibn Ezra, as we know, is not always so... So accommodating toward Chazal's Midrashim. In this case, he's happy to accept that Chazal had a tradition to that effect, and he's happy to accept that. Ibn Ezra, like some of the other commentaries, says that Paro's initial order to the midwives, Paro gave two genocidal orders. His first one was to the midwives. When that didn't work, he commanded the whole people. The first one was he intended to do it surreptitiously. He says even in Egypt, people understood that was chamas, that was an outrage to do such a thing, to just murder wholesale all the children. So he ordered the midwives, before anyone sees, before the child is born, you can get away with it, nobody will realize what you're doing. Because even in Paro's Egypt, some things were at least somewhat beyond the pale. The Ibn Ezra says, Paro called them in, and he told them, you deserve to die. You disobeyed my order. I'm the king, I make the rules here. Benos mavis, you deserve to die. Ki afachten mitzvasi, you disobeyed me and you deserve to die. What's your defense? They gave so they gave their defense, and I guess he accepted. He didn't kill them, or Hashem caused him to not kill them. And Ibn Ezra learns, like most commentaries, like the Talmud, like Rashi, when it says Hashem did good for them, v'yaslam batim, it means Hashem made them the batim was the good that Hashem made for them. Batim means good things. That is the standard. Ibn Ezra is not that far from the traditional pshat, from Talmud, from Rashi, except that he adds that bit about these two midwives being the chief midwives rather than all the midwives. Okay. Abarbanel and Malbim have some very interesting deviations from the standard interpretation. Abarbanel also grapples with this question of there are only two, what happened, you know, two midwives for all the people, he said. So he's not sure exactly. He wonders what's going on here as well. Not enough, he says. He says he is not actually happy with the idea that these were chief midwives. The Torah knows how to say the word chief. We just had back in Parshas Vayeshev and Parshas Vayigash. We had Sarah and Parshas Miketz, the Sarah Mashkim and the Sarah Ofim. When the Torah wants to say the chief, Rav HaTabachim, the Torah has words for chief. If these were the chief midwives, it would have called them Saras Mialdos or something like that. It just calls them Mialdos. It doesn't say anything about chief. The Torah knows how to say chief. So Ibn Ezra has a different proposal. Abarbanel has a different proposal. He says that In Egypt, the way the system of midwives were designed, he proposes, I have no idea if this can be corroborated or refuted in any way from archaeology or anything like that, from history, but he says that in Mitzrayim, the system was that there were two classes of midwives. There was one, he says, who would help the mother, who would be with the mother and help the mother. And there was another, he said, there was another midwife who would deal with the child, who would take the child out and cut the umbilical cord, do the things that the baby needed. One took the baby out and then made sure the baby, made sure the baby was okay, did the thing where they slap him on the back, I guess, make sure he's breathing, do all the things that you need to do to a baby. And the other one helped the mother. They helped her, kind of like a doula, he says. They helped her with words. They comforted her. They soothed her. They prayed with her. So one of them dealt with the mother, and one of them dealt with the baby. So the one who dealt with the mother was more of a talking role, a speaking role. She was called Pua. The Pua was the subcategory of midwife that provided kind of verbal and social aid to the mother. Kioledes Efe. And the other one was the Shifra. The Shifra was the one who dealt with the baby, provided like nursing care to the baby itself. So when it says Paro spoke to the Mialdos, so one was Shifra, one was Pua, he means one subcategory of Mialdos was called Shifra, and one was called Pua, and that is what a very creative idea of the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel then says something very interesting. He says, were these Mialdos, were they Jews or Egyptians? So we already mentioned Ibn Ezra, the Talmud, Rashi, Ibn Ezra seems to be on board with this. All assume they were Jews. It says on the Aldos Evrios, which the Talmud and Rashi Ibn Ezra assume were Jews. They were, maybe we know who they were, Yocheved and Miriam, or Yocheved and Elisheva, but they were Jews. Mialdos Evrios means Jewish Mialdos. That is also how the Pasuk is understood by some of the other Rishonim as well. Rashbam says, La Mialdos Ivrios, Mialdos Shehem Ivrios, Mialdos who are Jewish. Bukhar Shor says they were probably Jews, but Abarbanel suggests they were actually Egyptians. When it says Mialdos Ivrios, he says it means those who attended to the Jewish women who gave birth, the Mialdos of the Ivrios. Not Mialdos who are Ivrios, but Mialdos of the Ivrios. Bukhar Shor actually understands, Bukhar Shor was a great follower of Ibn Ezra, but Bukhar Shor here actually understands that Mialdos HaIvrios actually does mean, like Abarbanel, those who helped the Ivrios, but he says Mestama they were actually Jewish. The Pasuk is Mashma they were Jewish, he says, but in any event, he says that while the Rashbam says, and Chazal understood, it meant Jewish Mialdos, Abarbanel says they were Egyptian Mialdos. They were the ones who were treating the Jews, the ones who were helping the Jewish women give birth. They were certainly Mitzrayim, he says. Paro wasn't stupid. Paro knew he wasn't going to get anywhere with Jewish Mialdos. So, of course, Paro must have been talking to Egyptian Mialdos. And he assumed, he was counting on the fact that the Egyptian Mialdos, either that they hated the Jews, that they were anti-Semites like him, or that at least they wouldn't care about the Jews, they would listen to his instructions. He says, however, Paro was wrong. The Mialdos, even though they were Mitzrios, they were God-fearing. They feared God. They refused to cooperate in his genocidal scheme. And he reproved them. He said, why aren't you doing what I said? Mialdos gave an excuse. They said, they don't need us, and so on. So again, Hashem was good to the Mialdos. He has another pshat that Hashem actually caused the Mialdos. Mialdos weren't actually necessarily so good on their own, but he suggests that it was the Mitzrayim may have actually been evil, he said, but Hashem manipulated them. Hashem caused them to be good because that was what he wanted for his people. Okay, but in any event, then he has another very creative pshat. It says Vayas Lahem Batim. He made houses for them. So we usually assume, the Ibn Ezra and the Talmud and Rashi all say, that was what Hashem did. Hashem made houses for them, which is some kind of reward. He gave them some kind of reward, glory, some kind of schar. And that's an explanation of Vayitev Elokim Lamialdos. What did he do? Vayaslam Batim. Because Ki Yoroham Mialdos is Elokim, Vayaslam Batim. The Pasuk is a little repetitious because Pasuk is going back and forth. First the Pasuk says, Vayitiv Elokim Lamialdos, then it says, and the nation, Vayirapam Vayatum Ma'od, then it says, Vayiki Yoram Mialdos, Vyaslahem Batim. Seems to be repetitious. It just says, Like it just says, Vayitiv Elokim, and then it talks about the people, then it goes back to the Mialdas. Abarbanel has a very creative pshat. He says, Vayas Lahem Batim was not part of the reward, and it was not Hashem who did it. It was Paro who did it. That Hashem gave them the reward, whatever the reward was. When Paro saw that Mialdas weren't cooperating and he wasn't going to get anywhere with them because they were Yaru Esa Elokim, so Paro took them and he put them in houses, and his plan was that if the Jews wanted to call the Mialdos, they didn't have phones, so if the Jews wanted to call the Mialdos, they would have to go to the homes of these Mialdos who were in registered, known locations, knock on the door and say, come, we need help with a baby. Paro then told his people, Paro l'chol ha'amo lemar, keep an eye on those houses of the Mialdos, you know, watch their doors. Whenever you see a Jew go to the door and say, well, we're having a baby, go follow them home and then take the baby and throw them into the rivers. That was Paro's diabolical pshat. He put the Mialdos into houses where he could keep an eye on them, and that was his access to the Jewish life cycle. That's how he knew when the Jews were giving birth, because the Mialdos were in known observed locations. That's how he knew who was giving birth by seeing who went to their homes, and then he was able to try to kill the babies. Okay, Malbim follows the Abarbanel as well, even though Malbim is a great, very faithful to Chazal. Nevertheless, Malbim says Kafi Abshat. These Mialdos were Mitrias. They were not Jews. Unlike Chazal, who say they were some of the great famous Jews, Yocheved, Miriam, Elisheva, Malbim says, Kafi Apshat, these were Egyptians like the Abarbanel. And again, he says there were two categories of Mialdos, like Abarbanel, and so on. There were certainly not just two, he says, B'derech Apshat. And he goes on. And then the Malbim says something very interesting, which is what I want to focus on and pivot to what I want to discuss tonight. The Malbim says, when Paro told the Mialdos to kill the Jewish babies, it doesn't use the word Vayitzav. The Malbim is famous for his very close reading of words and distinguishing between why the Torah uses certain words here and certain words there. He points out that when Paro initially talked to the Mialdos, it doesn't use the word command. It says Paro told the Mialdos, Vayomer, he called them, Vayomer and Melech Mitzrayim LaMialdos, Vayomer, and he said, Bialetchen. Twice it says the word Vayomer, does not say the word Vayitzav. Later, for genocide round two, when he commanded the whole nation to kill the Jewish babies, throw them into the river, it says Vayitzav Paro l'chalamo, it says he commanded. Initially, when he spoke to the Mialdos, it just says that he spoke to them, he said to them. The Malbim picks up on this. The Malbim says that since Paro's initial attempt at genocide, like the earlier commentaries say, like Bechor Shar says, Ibn Ezra says, was meant to be surreptitious, Paro was not willing, had not brought himself yet to go out publicly as a monster. Paro was not willing to do that yet. So Paro was trying to keep the whole thing quiet. Paro was trying to get away with this whole thing without openly proclaiming himself to be a mass murderer. So he says that when Paro spoke to the Mialdos, he says he didn't give them a direct command. He made a suggestion to them. He spoke to the Mialdos and he said that this is what I think would be a good idea if you would do. Do it surreptitiously, of course, but he says the fact that he didn't kill them is because it wasn't a direct order. They would be rebbed. Like Ibn Ezra says, he actually confronted them and he says, you deserve to die. Malbim says, no, they didn't deserve to die because Paro has not made a direct order. Had Paro was willing to do this publicly, like he did later, he would have just given an open command. He says, originally, Paro still had some shame left. He still had some kind of conscience left. That he was boshed. He wasn't willing to commit mass murder. He wanted to do it quietly. Again, doing it quietly doesn't make you less of a murderer. It just makes you less of a public murderer, I guess. Okay, so somehow he counted on the Mitzrayim as being anti-Semites, Sonos as Yisrael, that they would hate Jews and they would do it joyously. Again, I'm not sure why this makes him any less of a murderer, but at least he was embarrassed to do it publicly. They say hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. So Paro at least had enough shame, had enough interest in maintaining a reputation as not being a mass murderer, that he wasn't willing to do this publicly. And part of that is he wouldn't give the Mialdos a direct order, anything official. He didn't do that. He just told them, This is my will, this is what I would appreciate if you would do this, and he was hoping they would do it without a direct order. It says the Mialdos feared God, so he says, combined with the fact that they had not received a direct order, that he had just told them, I would like you to do this, they said to themselves, it wasn't just Yiras Shamayim, they said to themselves, we can't say we're obeying orders here. We have no order, he says. if we do this, we're guilty of murder. We can't. The government has plausible deniability here. We never received an order. All we had was a preference from the king. That's not enough to save our skin if we commit murder. And that's why they didn't do it, because they hadn't received, again, the Torah says they were but tirena miyaldas esar elokim. But Malbim adds to that that they were saying, we don't have an order. He didn't actually demand that we do this. So if we do it, it's on us. It's our decision to kill the Jewish babies. Therefore, they said, no, thank you. If you're not taking responsibility for this, if you're not going to be the one, if you're not going to come out and issue a direct order that we can do this on your authority, we're not doing this. We're not taking the fall for this. You want this done? You do it done. We're not doing this. So okay, that's why Paro, he says, and he says, and again, they made excuses why they didn't do it. And he says Paro knew they didn't. Paro understood. Paro saw through their excuses. Paro knew why they didn't do it. Paro knew it was Yiras Elokim, and so on. But the okay. Paro didn't kill them, and so on. So both Ibn Ezra and the Malbim, point out that if the king gives an order and someone disobeys the order, then the king can kill you for that. According to Ibn Ezra, Paro actually confronted them directly and says, you deserve to die, you disobeyed my order. According to the Malbim, it was the opposite. The reason Paro never really confronted them, they weren't Chayav Misa, is because Paro had not been willing at that point to issue an actual order, and that's why they didn't listen to him, because they would have been responsible for the murder. They were not willing to do that, and that's why they did not obey Paro. So I want to discuss for the rest of our talk tonight, I want to discuss this question. We all take for granted, of course, that the Mialdos did the right thing, whether it was a direct order or not. Paro was a genocidal tyrant, Paro was a homicidal monster. And certainly there was, whether the Mialdos were Jews or Egyptians, there was certainly, it was clearly the right thing to do to disobey him. When the king tells you to murder innocent people, innocent babies, you certainly don't do it. But I want to discuss the halachic framework for this question. What is, where does the duty of loyalty and obedience to government end, and the duty to God and to one's conscience, to a moral code begin? What is the rule? What is the king have the right to demand that you ask? If the king, the government gives you an unlawful order, what are you supposed to disobey him? We know, of course, at Nuremberg, this was the famous issue that emerged from the Nuremberg trials, where many of the Nazis said we were just following orders, and the court established the legal principle. Apparently, it was not well established before that. I'm not a legal historian, but apparently, it had not been clearly established before that. That following orders is not an excuse. If an order is fundamentally immoral and unethical, you have a duty to not follow the order. So what is the Torah's attitude on this? What does the Torah actually say? What is the halacha if the king orders you to do something that is wrong? What does the Torah expect one to do? This point is discussed in both the Midrash and the Talmud. And the Talmud and Midrash are actually quite clear that you are supposed to ignore the king. Again, they're talking about cases where the king tells you to do something that is against halacha, that is against the Torah, in a formal sense. The Midrash and Talmud are pretty much unequivocal that you are supposed to ignore the king and follow the Torah. Midrash and Bamidbar Rabbah, a couple of places, brings the Pasuk in Koheles, Ani Pi Melech Shemar, that the Megillah says that a person is supposed to obey the king, is supposed to heed the commands of the king. However, that's true in general. In general, the Midrash says, yes, a person has a duty. The Torah considers, acknowledges the existence of a duty to obey the king. Darshan from Sukkim, Som Tasim Alecha Melech, Shemaro Alecha, you should fear the king. You should, in Yeshua, it says, Kol Asher Yamres Picha, you must, anyone who rebels against your order shall die. However, so the Midrash goes on, and it says that, Midrash goes on and says, not where the king tells you to do something that is against the Torah. You might think that the duty to obey the king is, in my country, right or wrong, is even if he tells you to do something that's against the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Talmud Lomar, another Pasuk in Koheles, Val Divrat Shvuas Elokim. The Torah tells you that Shvuas Elokim is the same Pasuk of Anipi Melech Shmar, Val Divrat Shvuas Elokim. Yes, in general, obey the Melech, but not when it comes to Shvuas Elokim, not when it comes to a Shvua that God made us swear to do. We have to, when they're in conflict, we have to nullify the will of the Basar Vadam, of the mortal king, before the Ratzon of Hashem, and we have to do, we already took a Shvua. It says in Chumash Dvarim, La'avrucha b'vris Hashem Elokechu v'alaso, we already took a Shvua to God, And that's what the Pasuk in Koheles means, Anipi Melech Shmar, yes, but not against Shvuas Elokim, our commitment to obey God as precedence, and therefore we do that even if it's against what the king wants. Later in B'midbar Rabbah, the same point, it says, in Mishlei this time, it says, Yiroes Hashem b'ni b'melech, a person should fear God and the king. The Midrash goes on, and it says, Yiroes Hashem b'melech, fear God and the king. You might think if the melech tells you to do Avodah Zarah, even Avodah Zarah, one of the most heinous sins in the Torah, you might think you should listen to him. Talmud Lomar, no, Yiroes Hashem. Hashem comes before the melech. The melech cannot tell you to do Avodah Zarah. That's what happened, of course, in Nebuchadnezzar. He told Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah to worship Avodah Zarah. They didn't listen. They said, we will not do it. We will not worship your God. We will not bow down to your idol, etc., etc. And they said, whether Hashem saves us or not, we're not going to do it. Our primary fealty, you know, we honor you as the king. We respect you as the king. We cannot listen to you if you tell us to do Avodah Zarah. And they said, Anipi Melech Shmar, yes, even though that there is a commandment, there is a mitzvah in general to obey the king. Anipi Melech Shmar, we go back to that pasuk, Val Divra Shvuas Elokim. They told the Melech, we accept your authority, we render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, we accept your authority on taxes and things like that. Civil matters, they said, Misim Va'ula Arnonios, Avalavad Avodah Zarah, Nuchanetzar at Vikelab Shavim, you and the dog, your authority is worthless to us when it comes to religion, when it comes to Avodah Zarah. That's it. We're not listening to you. So that's the Midrash. The Midrash says that we don't listen to the king when he tells us to do Averis. There is one discussion in the Talmud about this, in the Talmud Bavli, as well as the Talmud Yerushalmi briefly, actually. The discussion of the Talmud Bavli is a masterpiece. It's an intricate working together of several different narratives in Sefer Shmuel. Sefer Shmuel, we have Shaul HaMelech and David HaMelech. We have various of their inner circle, Yoav and Avner and Amasa. And the Talmud actually has an interwoven thread of narratives in which it brings out this principle that we do not obey the king when he tells us to be over the Torah. The Talmud is discussing the Haftarah that we just read. It actually has to do with the Haftarah that we read yesterday. That David's command to Shlomo HaMelech, to his son, when David was dying, he said, Anochi holek b'derech kol ha'aretz, and he gave him various specific instructions. One of them was to kill Yoav. He said, Gamata yadata eis asher asa liyoav ben Tzeruya, you know what Yoav did. What did he do? Asher asa l'shnei tzarei tzivos Yisrael, what he did, he killed two generals of Israel, la'avner b'ner, la'amasa ben Yeser. Avner Ben-Ner had been a lieutenant of Shaul, who had eventually come over to David's side. Yoav then killed him. Amasa ben Yeser also was someone, I think, who had originally been with Shaul, but now was on David's side. Yoav killed both of them. Vayahar game, Vayasente Muhammad b'shalom, and he spilled blood in peacetime. Vayitain dmei Muhammad b'chagor asoa shebemasno v'nalo shebaraglav, he has blood on his hands. Vasisa kechach masecha, do according to your wisdom. Lo sarit zivasa b'shalom shaol. Don't let him die peacefully of old age. Make sure you punish him. So David commanded Shlomo to kill Yoav, and the reason was because Yoav had committed two murders for which he had not been punished yet. So the Talmud in Sanhedrin discusses these two murders of Yoav in detail, and it explains what Yoav was thinking, why Yoav felt he was justified in killing these two people. Why did he kill Amasa? So the Gemara actually presents this in a court case where Shlomo interrogated Yoav, and he asked him, why did you kill Amasa? He said, my defense is, Amasa mar b'malchus hava. Amasa had rebelled against David HaMelech, and therefore he deserved to die. How did Amasa rebel against David HaMelech? So it brings a pasuk in Shmuel Beis. It says that, I think this was during the merit of Avshalom, that David said, I need an army. David and Amasa was working with him at this time, and David told Amasa, Hazek li es ish Yehuda shloshes yamim, go to ish Yehuda and muster me an army promptly. It says, V'yelech Amasa l'hazek es Yehuda, v'yuchar, Amasa went to do his commission, but he delayed. He didn't do it. David said within 3 days. So Amasa did not do it within 3 days. He tarried. He did not do it right away. Said Yoav, the king gave you an order, 3 days, you chose not to do so, you're a Marid B'Malchus, I am therefore going to kill you. So Shlomo said, no, actually, Yoav, you are wrong. Amasa was correct. Amasa was correct in refusing the order of David HaMelech. Why? Amasa achin v'rakin darash. Amasa was darash achin v'rakin. What does that mean? That refers, the Gemara goes on to explain, Amasa went to do promptly David's orders, to go muster people from Yehuda for David's army. He saw they had begun a new mesechta. Ashkechinu de pasiach lubim mesechta. They had begun studying Torah. They had begun a certain stage in their study of Torah. Amasa said, wait a second. Can I draft these men for the army? It's not a good time right now. They're learning Torah. This is a sensitive time. They just started a new mesechta. He said, I can't interrupt them. But the king told me I have to. So he said, the pasuk that says I have to obey the king, it's a pasuk in Yeshua. We read it before. Kalisha Shayamres Picha Yumas. Anyone who doesn't listen to him, anyone who doesn't listen to Yeshua, to the king, rebels against an order of the king, shall die. V'lo Yishamas Tevarecha, who will not listen to your words, they told Yeshua. L'chol Teshu Tzabenu Yumas. Anyone who doesn't listen to any command you give shall die. Amasa said, Yachal Afilu Devrei Torah. Maybe that means even if the king's order involves Bittul Torah, involves taking someone away from Torah, Talmud Lomar, Rak Chazak Ve'amat. The pasuk in Yeshua ends with the words Rak Chazak Ve'amat, only be strong. The famous approach of Chazal, a hermeneutical approach, that Rak is a limitation. Amasa said, Rak, the Torah, the Navi is placing a limitation on the king's authority. The limitation is, if the king tells you to do something which is against the Torah, in this case, causing Bittul Torah, that's against the Torah, therefore I cannot do this. The king has no authority to tell me to take somebody away from study of Torah, and therefore I will not do this. And Shlomo agreed with Amasa. Shlomo said, Yoav, you were wrong. What you did was murder. Amasa was not guilty of treason, of rebelling against the king. You are the one who was guilty of killing him. He was right, because he derived the correct halachic principle that we do not obey the king when the king's order is illegitimate. When the king's order is against the Torah, it is disregarded. The Gemara goes on. The Gemara says that it says later about Yoav. It says in Perek Bey, is the Perek after the Haftarah. It says v'heishiv Hashem es damo al rosho. That Hashem will bring him to account for the blood that he spilled. Asher paga b'shnei anashim tzadikim v'tovim imenu. Yoav had murdered two men who were better than him, tzadikim from him, tovim from him. Yoav killed two men who were both better than him. And Shlomo did eventually kill Yoav, and the Navi saying that the people that Yoav's execution was just because he deserved to die for the two people he had killed. The two people he had killed were Avner and Amasa. And the Gemara says, why were they tzaddikim from Yoav? Where do we find that were greater than Yoav? Where do we find that were tovim from Yoav? The Gemara says, because they were darash achin v'rakin. And he was not. V'hu lo darash. So we'll explain what that means in a moment. They were tovim, they were better than him, because they learned Torah more correctly. They were darash achin v'rakin, and Yoav was not. They understood the rule that we're supposed to refuse unlawful orders, and Yoav did not. And tzaddikim, they were tzaddikim, greater tzaddikim than him. Shehem bepev lo asu, they had received a direct, face-to-face, oral order, and they refused it. V'hubi geres, he only had a written order, it was more remote apparently, and he obeyed the order. What is this talking about? What are these various events? Rashi, again, I always point out the Talmud, even though the Talmud doesn't always engage in pshuto shel mikra, the Talmud always assumes that the reader, the studier of Talmud, has a good knowledge of Tanakh. Much better than I often have, but the Talmud often takes for granted that you actually are familiar with the stories in Tanakh and you know what assumptions it's making. So Rashi explains, for those of us who don't know the stories, Rashi explains, Avner and Amasa had both refused unlawful orders earlier in their career because of this din, because they were Darish, Ach, and Varakin. They said, you have to listen to the Melech, Rak, Hazak, Vamat, not if it's an unlawful order. Where do we find that Amasa and Avner refused unlawful orders? Amasa, we had the earlier Gemara, that Amasa refused the order to draft the men of Yehuda because they were at a critical time in their Torah study and it would have been contrary to the law of the Torah to draft them. Where do we find Avner refused an order? So this one is not explicit in the Pesukim. Neither one is explicit in the Pesukim, but this one Rashi tells us on his own. As we'll see, it's Yerushalmi as well, but this one Rashi tells us on his own. Way back in Shmuel Aleph, when Shaul was the Melech. So David had fallen out. David had initially been a protege of Shaul. David had fallen out of favor. Shaul was hunting David. David at one point took refuge in the city of Nov, Ira Kohanim. Nov, the city of Kohanim. When Shaul found out, he was furious. He felt that the city of Nov had committed treason by harboring David. There was a misunderstanding that the city of Nov didn't realize that David had fallen out of favor. They knew he used to be Shaul's favorite, and they hadn't realized that he was now on the run from Shaul. Anyway, Shaul had become so obsessed with killing David, what the whole city had done, he felt they were all deserving of death. He was persuaded by his advisor, by Doeg, the Gemara says, the Tzukim indicates, the Gemara says. So Shaul, one of Shaul's great crimes, one of his great sins, Shaul ordered the massacre of the entire city of Nov, Ira Kohanim. So the Pasuk says, when it discusses what happened to Nov, the Pasuk says in Sefer Shmuel, he said, Vayomer ha-melech l'ratzim ha-nitzav malav. The Melech told some of his officials, some of his attendants, Sobu v'hamisu Kohani Hashem, go around and kill the Kohani Hashem. Ki gam yadim im David, they're traitors, they're supporting the traitor David, go kill them. No one has told me about this. No one told me he was there. They didn't tell me that he had been there. They're traitors. Go kill them. So it says that the people would not do it. It says initially it says that several of Shaul's lieutenants refused. It says Vlo avu avdei hamelech l'shalach es yadim b'chayin Hashem. Shaul's avadim, unnamed avadim, but certain avadim that he had refused to do it. They said we will not kill the Kohani Hashem. So it says, Doeg did it. Doeg was a great rusher, according to Chazal. Doeg was the one who did it. But initially, it says there were other Avdei HaMelech who refused to do it. Says Rashi, Rashi and the Bavli and Sanhedrin, who were these Avdei HaMelech who refused to kill Novir Akarnim, who refused Shaul's order? These Avadim included Avner. Avner had been at that time one of Shaul's leading lieutenants. That when Shaul said, kill the Kohanim of Nov, Avner said, I will not do this. This is wrong. This is murder. I will not do this. Avner refused. So Rashi and the Radak both bring this Gemara on in their commentary to Shmuel, that the people who refused included Avner. Says the Bavli, again, it assumes you know all this background, says the Bavli, so that Shlomo, the Navi in Malachim Perek Beis, is contrasting the conduct of Yoav himself and Avner and Amasa. Avner and Amasa refused to obey unlawful orders from Shaul and from David, because they said, this is wrong, this is against the Torah. Amasa refused to draft soldiers when there was an unacceptable issue of Bittul Torah involved. Avner refused to execute the Kohanim of Nov, because he felt that it was not right, they did not deserve to die. Even though they had heard these orders directly from the respective kings, Shaul had ordered Avner directly, and he said no. David had ordered Amasa, Amasa said no. However, Yoav did not do this. Yoav, once in his career, was faced with an unlawful order, and Yoav was not Darish Achen Varakin. Yoav obeyed the unlawful order, even though he only got it in writing. What is this a reference to? This one is actually explicit in the Pesukim. This, of course, is the famous story of David and Uriah Hachiti. Uriah was one of David's loyal soldiers fighting his wars. David had gotten involved with Bathsheba, Uriah's wife, who was home. When Uriah had a furlough, when Uriah came home, David had ordered him to go back to Bathsheba to cover up his involvement with her. Uriah refused. He says, my brothers are fighting the wars of the king on the field of battle. How can I go home? How can I experience comfort and security when my comrades are fighting in the field? He refused to go home. David then saw that his attempt to cover up what had happened wasn't going to work. He gave an order to Yoav, who was the general. He said, I need Uriah killed. He said, go take Uriah and deploy him to the front, to a dangerous spot of the battle, and then pull back the army from around him where he'll get killed by the enemy. And David ordered Yoav to basically murder Uriah. Yoav did so, and Yoav brought about the death of Uriah. David was later criticized for this. The Navi said, "Oso harakta b'chera b'nei Ammon." There actually is a lot of discussion in the Talmud whether David was actually considered a murderer for this or not, whether the Talmud actually says Uriah himself was a murderer by Malchus, because he had refused David's order to go back to his wife, or for other reasons. But the Talmud actually justifies David elsewhere and said that David's punishment of Uriah was actually legitimate. But nevertheless, he might not have been an outright murderer, but the Navi does fault him for doing this. And our Gemara is taking for granted that the order to kill Uriah was an unlawful order, and Yoav was wrong in obeying it. So the Gemara is pointing out, the Gemara is teaching us, is there was an ironic contrast between Yoav and the men he killed. The men he killed, he considered them to be Marduk Malchus. One of them were Marduk Malchus. They were actually right. They knew the limits of the authority of the Melech. They refused. The order Amasa had refused was, Amasa was correct in refusing the order because it was an illegitimate order. Similarly, Avner, earlier in his career, had refused an improper order. They were right. They were tzaddikim v'tovim imenu. Yoav was wrong. Yoav didn't understand this principle. Yoav thought that Amasa was guilty of, even though the order he had disobeyed was an illegitimate order. And Yoav himself apparently had made this error as well. In his service of David, he had killed Uriah Hiti, even though he should have refused that order because it was not correct, it was not legitimate. And Yoav, therefore, was not as great as they were. Yoav failed in his duty to God by following the king blindly, even when the order should have been disobeyed. I should mention that we've been focusing on a somewhat negative portrait of Yoav. The Talmud also says there are some opinions that Yoav was a great tzaddik. The Talmud talks about how he was a pious man, a God-fearing man, he was generous, and the Talmud actually brings, interwoven with this, the Talmud brings opinions that Yoav was actually a great tzaddik. I certainly do not want to calumniate Yoav and give you the impression that he's being considered a rasha by the Talmud, but in this area of following the king, the Talmud is developing a theme that Yoav had the wrong idea, that Yoav's attitude was, you obey the king regardless. He was actually wrong. Amasa and Avner were correct. You are not supposed to obey an order of the king when the order is illegitimate. There's a version of this in the Talmud Yerushalmi as well. Talmud Yerushalmi elsewhere in Sanhedrin. It brings this pasuk in Shmuel that when Shaul commanded his lieutenants to destroy Novir HaKohanim, and they said no, who were they? Avner and Amasa. And the way the Yerushalmi says it, though, their objection wasn't explicitly that it was an unlawful order. They had a different objection. The way they phrased their refusal was, they told him, "Klum islach alinon ela hadein zonara v'hadein kalanirin." You don't pay us enough. What do we have for you? We have a fancy uniform. We have elegant clothes. Hatrifin l'cha, take it. You're not paying us enough to kill these people. So they were saying that we're not going to do this. Just because you pay us and you're our patron, that doesn't mean we're going to do everything you want. We are not doing this. So they weren't making an explicitly moral case. They were just saying, we choose not to do this. And again, it's a strange point to make. You don't pay us enough. That's not why you listen to the king. You listen to the king because Halacha recognizes that the king has authority. So Yerushalmi puts this curious argument into their mouth that says, they said, we don't need your money. If it's your patronage that you're counting on, we don't need it. Yeah, we're handing in our, here's our badge. Yeah, we're turning in our badge. Goodbye. You know, we don't work for you anymore, basically. Okay, an interesting thing. Rambam actually codifies these rules. Even though this is largely an Agadata Gemara, the Rambam codifies these rules. Rambam writes that the Marid B'Malchus, the king can kill him. Anyone, even if it's a simple order, someone disobeys, the king says, go here. Or the king says, don't leave your house. You disobey a simple order of the king, even if it's not treason, national security. The king just says, do something. You don't do it. The king has the right to kill you. That's what the Pasuk in Yeshua says. King can kill people who disobey him. However, the Rambam writes, Hamavatal Zeris Hamelach B'Shvil Shnas Asik B'Mitzvahs, someone who disobeys the king's order because he's busy doing a mitzvah, even a minor mitzvah, he's potter. Divrei Harav, Divrei Talm Ever, Divrei Harav Kodman. Rambam explains the reason we don't listen to the king. He brings the famous rule that the words of the master and the words of the servant, the words of the slave, who do we listen to? Words of the master. As per the B'midbar Rabbah, that Yiraz Hashem B'niv HaMelech. Fear Hashem, fear the king. Fear Hashem first. Divrei HaRav has precedence over Divrei HaEved. V'ein Tzorech Lomar, it goes without saying, the Rambam says, if the king orders you to mevatzel a mitzvah, even if it's not a direct order, if it's just that you're busy doing a mitzvah, you don't have to stop to obey the king, certainly if the king orders you to violate a mitzvah, She'ein Shomin Lo, this is the halacha. This is pretty much, you know, unlike other areas of halacha where there are two sides to everything, this is something that is pretty unequivocal, as we've seen. The Talmud, the Midrashim, if the king gives an unlawful order, we do not obey it. It's the our allegiance to God goes first. The devil, of course, is in the details, what is called an unlawful order. And just to quote one fascinating concrete application of this, this issue of halacha did not get a lot of attention over the years. We didn't have Jewish kings, and it was taken for granted that when the Russian Tsar or would tell you to do an Avera, we wouldn't listen to him. But this became a fierce discussion about 20 years ago. Gaza. We're back in Gaza today. But in 2005, during the Gaza disengagement, this was a hotly debated question in religious Zionist circles. The government had decided that they were doing the disengagement. This was a terribly controversial move at the time. Religious people, non-religious people across Israel had passionate feelings about this, had vehement opinions about this. And one of the questions that arose in religious Zionist circles was, assuming the right wing of religious Zionism felt that the policy was unconscionable, it was against the Torah, it was bad for national security, they felt it was a terrible, terrible policy. The question was, should soldiers obey orders to evict settlers, to evict whoever lived in Gaza? Should soldiers obey orders to carry out the disengagement? There were some on the right who said the answer is no, perhaps most prominently Rav Avraham Kahana Shapiro, one of the greatest leaders of the right wing of religious Zionism. He said that soldiers should disobey orders to carry out various aspects of the disengagement. Rav Avraham Kahana Shapiro had been former Ashkenazic chief rabbi, the head of Merkas Harav. He was a leader of the right wing of religious Zionism. He issued a ruling saying that soldiers should disobey orders. He said, according to Torah law, it is forbidden to give back land in Israel to non-Jews. It's a prohibition of Lo Sechanem. It's also a bitul of mitzvahs yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Every Jew is obligated to obey these mitzvahs, soldier and civilian, he says. In order to evacuate Jews, in order to give the land to non-Jews, it is keneged the Torah. Any order that's contrary to halacha, he says, has no validity. Rambam says, we just read the Rambam. Ein Tzorach Lomar, the Rambam says, if the king tells you to mevatel a mitzvah, you don't listen. Says Rav Shapiro, orders to carry out the disengagement because he had established to his satisfaction that the disengagement violated halacha. Therefore, he says, it is a direct corollary of that orders to carry out the disengagement should be disobeyed. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who was one of the leaders of the moderate or more dovish factions of religious Zionism, and was in general a much more nuanced and thinker, much more complex and multifaceted thinker, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was very displeased with this attitude. He actually expressed his objection very, very moderately. He said he has questions. He wrote with great respect to Rav Shapiro. But at great length, he argued he did not agree with Rav Shapiro. Unlike Rav Shapiro, whose position is simple, easy to state, and you can pretty much say it in two sentences, as we just did, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's position was, as the man was, much more subtle and complex and sophisticated. He went on for pages explaining his views. But his basic position was that, yes, there's no question Rav Shapiro was right about the halacha, that if the king gives a patently, if the king, the government, whoever it is, the prime minister, if the government gives an order that directly violates halacha, yes, there's no question the halacha is, as we've established, that you would disobey the order. That's clear. However, Rav Lichtenstein said, reasonable people can disagree about the disengagement. He says reasonable people can disagree about whether this will in the long term, promote or degrade Israel's security, as well as the demographic character of the people, he said. People disagree. He says it's not clear. Society hasn't reached a consensus, whether it's legal or illegal, moral or immoral, he said. It's a complicated issue. No one knows the future. As Rav Aaron mentioned, he said that predictions about the future, he says making predictions about the future. There's no certainty, he says. We can't know for sure. He says, we really don't know, he says. No one really knows for sure. In such a case, he says, the government basically has to be the one to decide. He says, you can't simply say that anyone who has a personal opinion about whether a certain policy is good for Israel or bad for Israel can say, therefore, I feel this is not in Israel's best interest, therefore it's against the Torah, therefore I can disobey the order. He says, if we believe this is in Israel's best interest, it'll save Jewish lives, then that's Pikuach Nefesh, he says. Pikuach Nefesh overrides all these concerns of Lo Tzachanim and Ish of Eretz Yisrael. To save lives, he says, that's a paramount consideration. That's not so simple. As we've been learning in the Kollel, there are actually opinions that say that national policy does not have to take into account individual lives. It takes into account the best interest of the nation. But in general, Baron Lichtenstein says, people argued whether this is in the best interest of the nation. They argued about whether it would be save lives or cause lives, the short term, the long term. He says, Rav Lichtenstein argues, he says, this is not a simple black and white case of the government saying to do something which is clearly asur al pi halacha. There's no certainty. The reasonable people disagree. Experts disagree, and so on, he says. Once we can accept that it's an issue of pikuach nefesh, he says, and furthermore, he says, if we disobey orders, that degrades the army, he says. It'll lead to the damage to the unity and cohesion of the army. Readiness for mutual dedication and sacrifice is clear. That itself is pikuach nefesh, he says. So we're dealing with pikuach nefesh on both sides, he says. We're not dealing with a simple question of an order to do an iser, which has no consequences beyond that. We're dealing with profound questions about the overall security and well-being of the Jewish people, the lives of Jewish people, the effectiveness of the army, he says. These types of questions are not really susceptible to a simple question of the order is lawful, it's against the Torah, it's not against the Torah. We have to take into account all these broader considerations. Again, I'm not really doing Rav Aaron's position justice. I don't know that I fully understand it. He goes on for pages and several rounds of letters trying to explain this. Rav Shapiro and his partisans kept making the simple point that we look at what's before us. There's an issur to give up Eretz Yisrael. Pikuach Nefesh is not clear one way or another. We're living through Gaza now. It's not all that clear. In hindsight, it's certainly not clear the disengagement was all that salubrious for the health of the Jewish people. So Rav Shapiro's position was easy to state. The king tells you to do something. It's against the Torah. You don't do it. That's it. Rav Aaron, though, Rav Lichtenstein held that it's a much more complex matter when we're dealing with the effectiveness of the military, national policy, lives of the Jewish people. At some point, he says, the issues become vastly more, the stakes become so much higher than the individual order. And in such cases, he says, we can't just have soldiers making their own decisions. Someone has to decide. That someone is the government. As long as the government is not doing something that is clearly and generally recognized as wrong and harmful and illegal and immoral, he says, even if there are good arguments on both sides, we should defer to the government and we should not simply allow individual soldiers to disobey orders and do whatever they want. Again, in the course of his discussion, Rav Aaron says, of course it's obvious if the government would come tomorrow and say, do a training exercise on Shabbos. There's no need for it, but you know, we don't care about Shabbos in the army. We command you to just do your non-essential work on Shabbos. Of course, a direct statement like that would be a command to be over the Torah, we would disregard. There's no question Rav Shapiro was right about that. But in these types of questions, policy questions, where good arguments, reasonable arguments can be made on both sides, there, of Lichtenstein felt, it's not simply a matter of, we can't just take the reductionist attitude, this is wrong, it's against Torah, therefore I, an individual soldier, can disobey orders. It's not that simple. The consequences for the effectiveness of the army and for the safety of Klal Yisrael are profound, and the question has to be dealt with in a much more nuanced and sophisticated way than just to say that the government policy is against Torah and I'm going to disregard it.